This is part two of our interview with Helen Brown, and this is Amy Kitchener, and we're in Hermosa Beach on July 9th, 1993. Helen, we already talked a little bit about when you were growing up, but one thing I wanted to ask you was, whether there are certain important experiences or lessons or values that you remember when you were growing up that you've carried with you.
If there were at that time, I really wasn't conscious of it. However, as I've grown up here and gotten older, had children of my own who often ask me, what was I like when I was a kid? Well, naturally, I would go back, or how were you, Mom, when you were a kid? You know, sometimes those kind of memories would stream back. But essentially what I remember there was a very happy, you know, childhood. By that I mean early childhood through about 16, because that's the age when I came over here. As far as values, as I said before, with the language in the family being essentially English, because that was what was expected in the islands during that time, and I never did learn the language, my mother's language, which was Ilocano, except I would hear it whenever friends of the family would come over to visit. So it wasn't only a smattering of understanding Ilocano, but also Spanish, because many of our friends were of Spanish background. They were, because of the friendships that grew up because of the Spanish colonization. In fact, my godmother was part Spanish, and those languages kind of defined the culture for me. So it was kind of like a three kind of cultures kind of infused each other in terms of their values. But I learned that in terms of values, not so much through the languages as being, you know, visiting, you know, I could see the respect for elders that was very evident. We were taught to be, you know, very considerate of elders. For example, if I remember one time when we had some relatives visiting, and I was very anxious to get away because my boyfriend was waiting downstairs. We were going to go play tennis. And so I was rushing down the stairs, and I was called back and said, "Haven't you forgotten your manners?" You know. So I had to stay and talk a little bit, how glad I am that you're here, and blah, blah, and then, excuse me, go on. But so those things, you know, were taught to me. And then, of course, that would carry over also during, you know, meal times. We were expected, you know, to be home. And but what I remember the most was absorbing what might be, you know, my greatest absorption, if you want to call it that, of the Filipino culture, my mother's culture in the northern Philippines, because we would go there for a vacation whenever school was out. We usually left in March, because that's when schools were over, and then they would start again in June, because that's the time when when members of families were expected to be home to help, you know. Well, in the villages and things, the children were expected to be home to help with the chores. So that's when I would, you know, learn a lot about relating with my grandparents and to learn, you know, the food and things of that kind.
Did they teach you to do cooking?
No. No, we, in the Philippines, we didn't do those things because we had maids and they did everything. So all we were expected to do was to study, behave ourselves, because everything else, you know, was done for us. And that's why it was very difficult when I came over. And I remember my mother was very difficult on her because she had to survive without the help that she was used to, you know, back in the islands. And my father wasn't any help because he never did anything, you know, at home or as far as growing up here in the States. So he wasn't sensitive to the needs. Like, for example, he didn't tell us, you know, that we could go down to Sears and buy a vacuum cleaner to clean the rugs. I remember coming over here and cleaning the rug with a broom, you know, and the dust would fly all over the place, and then I had the extra chore of dusting off. Well, I'm kind of sidetracking there.
Oh, well, that's interesting, contrasting the two
experiences. Oh, I know.
And
so it was very difficult. However, you know, here I just love gardening. It's a kind of a release for me, and I love to garden. I love to handle the soil, you know, and stuff like that. I usually don't wear gloves because it doesn't feel the same, you know what I mean, that I learned over here. But, you know, when I was growing up, you didn't touch anything that's any gardening, or that was the job of the houseboy or the maid or whatever, you know.
Were there other kinds of things that were very different that you had to adjust to when you first came to the United States?
What other things?
Were there other, you were saying how it was very sort of difficult and traumatic for your mother, especially now she had to...
Well, I think I mentioned one of the main things was my hesitancy in knowing really how to make friends here, because I seemed far behind socially, you know, than my own peer groups, you know, of children who were growing up here. I had no identification either with Spanish-speaking or Hispanics. They were all, you know, white people that I was going on, and they seemed so much more advanced than I. They were interested in other things. I was apparently very much although in my late teens, I seemed to be rather immature. I'd rather play games and stuff, and the kids were all dating and stuff like that. I remember my mother, we were driving down Colorado in Pasadena, and here were these kids in front, you know, and they were in a turtleback. You know, those when they had the rumble seat, you know, and they were necking away, you know, what my mother was, Helen, look at that. And so, you know, it was really very hard for me. It took me a long while to really blossom out, you know. Even into my dating with my first dates around, you know. But it came, you know, even after I was married, I attributed, I was I tell my friends, you think I'm very outgoing now. I never was this way. You wouldn't have known me when I was in my early 20s or whatever. I was very quiet, whatnot, you know. But I attribute a lot of my coming out, well, of course, to school and then also mainly to Bill, because he was very supportive and he was very outgoing and, you know, so it was really, really a very lonesome period for me in my life when I first came here and through college, really, and in my early teaching career. But what developed, you know, was more like a studious type, lonely, quiet, you know, kind of a person.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what were your impressions of Los Angeles? How did the city strike you
Well, the main thing about the city was were the movies, you know, and the houses, you know, and the streets. They were all paved, you know. Of course, there were some streets in Manila that were there, but not the. In terms of the numbers, you know, and the orderly traffic and things of that kind. And it's kind of a long way to remember, but that's the way it seemed to me as I look back. It's great, you know. Boy, there's a lot of things to do, and school. School was all day. Here wasn't that way when I was going to school. We woke up early in the morning in Manila, 7 o'clock. We were in school, and even in high school, and we were through at 12:30. We didn't have lunch. Things the whole afternoon we were free and go home, and then we always had a nap, usually a siesta. Everybody went to sleep or didn't do anything between 12 and 2. Even my dad would come home from his work and be home and lunch. And then the afternoon was free for games or study or whatever. So when we came over here, there's always something doing all the time, you know. School was all day. We'd have cafeteria, lunch at school, and so, and a lot of activities. So I remember being very busy in those early times.
Did your family go places on weekends or? What kinds of places did you go to for leisure?
Well, I think my memory is it wasn't so much going out as it was staying at home. We lived in an acre of land. We were kind of isolated. It was undeveloped land at that time that is now West Arcadia. It's not too far from where the racetrack is, not anywhere near like it is here. So lots of our activities were at home. And with my brothers and my sister. And I loved, that's where I started liking, you know, gardening and taking care of pets. And I used to earn extra money by raising chickens. And we had goats. And that's my early memory of, you know, what we did. I don't remember going out to too many places at all.
That must have been very different from your life in the Philippines, too.
Oh, it was very different.
Back to the land.
Well, yeah. In the Philippines, you had a lot of family around. And everybody was the same. I mean, we liked to do the same things. We liked going to the ocean. We lived kind of near Manila Bay. And after school, we'd go to the Y, you know. And our interests were the same, you know. And there was nothing different between us. Because, too, we were all... The groups that I went with were more or less comfortable, you know, families. And I'd compare this with the children who were very low income. They didn't live in the city. They lived kind of on the border, and they called them the little barrios. And I used to, when I was, that was another thing when I was a kid. We lived, we used to have a large yard, and the gardeners would come and take care of the yard and throw the wood and trash and stuff behind the big bamboo trees over the fence. And I used to get acquainted with the little children who used to come over there and search for wood and throw away things. And they lived across the field in the what we call the little barrio, with the typical Nipa hut that was up on stilts, you know, to keep it from getting wet during the storms. So I used to be friends with these little children, and I enjoyed it, you know. My mother would not, or the family would not, allow us to go outside the fence. Well, I guess that was first. I'm thinking of maybe that was the time when I started rebelling and being an activist, because I'd sneak out the fence and play with them, you know. And there were that thought just came into my mind. And there was a big field, you know, in the back, and then there was a railroad, and you'd look across the big river, which was called the Pasig River, and on the other side was the palace of the governors, you know, Malacañang Palace, they called it, in the distance. And in between there was this little village of Nipa houses and things, where these little kids lived. And so... I used to get wood from the house and stuff, you know, go out there and give it to them, and I used to go out and play with them, and the carabaos, you know, the carabaos would be in those fields, because they are the beast of burden, is that what you call, for the farmers? And they didn't have any sweat glands. They're not like the ones that you see in India, you know, with the hump, which are the... So these carabaos would have to eventually, you know, dig their own round pond. And, of course, with the frequent rains, there would be water in there, and the carabao would come and immerse themselves, you know, in there. And we used to... watch them and whatnot. And then when they weren't there, especially during the rainy season, why, the frogs would come. And of course, they would have these tadpoles all over the place. And the kids and I would catch those tadpoles and, you know, kind of, and I still remember I would be barefoot. Am I going out of the
way? You're doing fine.
I would go out there barefoot with these kids. They were barefoot. And I can still feel that mud oozing through my toes. It was a very nice feeling. I loved it, you know. Well, anyway, we became so well acquainted that they took me to visit their house. And it seemed like their father, and you had to climb a bamboo ladder to get up to the first floor. And it was all one big room with bamboo slats for the floor, because everybody slept on the floor at night, and the kitchen was part of one part of the house and so forth. So it turned out that the father of this one particular family was a box maker. And that's how he, one way that he made his living, he made these jewelry boxes. And they were made in the form of a book. Here comes books now. Well, anyway, then, you know, these old-fashioned covers that you see on books that are old for the inside cover, they were all covered with that kind of paper, and you open it up and it was a jewelry box kind of, or a box that you could keep keepsake. So I was given, you know, some of those take home, and I know that was a big thing for them to do, but I always remember that, and I brought it over with me when we came over, but unfortunately I don't know what happened to it. I wish that I had it. But anyway, so those are some of the kind of fun things, you know, we kind of did when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about your grandparents?
Well, my grandparents, of course, would be the parents of my mother. My father hardly talked about his family, and wasn't until we came to this country that brought his older sister to come live with us in Arcadia, and she told us a little bit, you know, about the family, but not very much. My knowledge of my dad's family is very skimpy. But living in the islands, I knew my mother's parents, my grandparents, maternal grandparents, quite well. My grandparent belonged to a very prominent family, and my grandmother belonged to a storekeeper family, from what I remember. This is up in the northern Philippines. And the story that I have, as I've gathered it, you know, from stories whenever we'd go up there for vacation and whatnot, was that my grandfather was studying to be a friar, a priest. And he was traveling in the province, and he stopped at this store, which was the store of my grandmother's mother. And so he was thirsty and whatever, and so they served him whatever it was. But the one who served him was this little 13-year-old child. And he's supposed to have fallen in love with her right away, you know. And she was kind of fair. I think I showed you her picture, didn't I?
I think so.
And he forgot all about being a friar priest. And so a little later, I was told that they got married. She was quite young. And she was half Spanish and half Filipino. And actually, she was supposed to have been up in a tree, climbing up in a tree, when she was being called down by the elders of the family to come get ready because you're getting married. You know? And so that's what happened. And so they got married, and she had, in her lifetime, she had 10 children. And but she was quite young, as you can imagine. So the elder children especially were farmed out to maiden aunts or others to be raised, because My grandmother wasn't able to do so. And my mother was farmed out to a spinster aunt that was a school teacher. And she apparently was very religious, brought up very religious in the Catholic Church. And my mother absorbed all of this. And my mother was very religious. And I've noticed that all through, you know, her life. And
did that then influence you and your brothers and sisters?
Well, my brothers and sisters? Well, yes. My father was not a Catholic. He was, in fact, he was, I've heard, and I have not verified this, but I heard that he was attending Westminster College in Missouri. That's the college, you know, where Churchill came and donated that quaint English church and placed it on the campus, I think, and Churchill came over there and did one of his famous speeches, and later on Reagan came over and donated part of the Berlin Wall over there. It's kind of a well-known little college, and I went over there later in life and stayed for about 3 or 4 days and looked up my dad's records and talked to the people over there and looked at things. What am I doing here? Well, anyway, you asked about how the effect of my mother being very religious affected the children. But we had this kind of a double exposure to. My dad in the Philippines continued to be Presbyterian, went to the Presbyterian Church. My mother went to the Catholic Church. We were all baptized as Catholics because that was the contract, you know, when they got married. And but gradually as we got older, the children seemed to divide kind of naturally, you know. Some went on to be with my dad in his church, and the others went with my mother. And I went along with my dad, largely because I liked the singing. You know, at that time, the Catholic Church didn't have the songs that they have today. But the Protestant churches, they always had the hymns, you know, singing. Not only that, but after the service, they had a library, and they had the Bobbsey Twins and, you know, Pollyanna, all those Americans. So we'd always borrow all these books, and so we had the Sunday school teachers would take us out on excursions, and I even remember some of the songs. So that's the way it was, and to this day, let me see, Mary, the oldest, Ted, one of the twins, my sister Julia, and my brother George. So four of them are very staunch Catholics today. Joe, my second oldest, remained a Protestant, married a Protestant. He's now deceased. And then I'm in kind of, I don't know what I am. I guess I'm eclectic, I guess. But I still maintain that I'm a non-practicing Catholic. I've been asked to join different churches, and I said no. I was baptized a Catholic, but I don't go regularly, just like I don't go regularly to church here or wherever I was going. I appreciated wherever I went. I felt that we had the same God. I felt that kind of a spirituality. And so But my, I don't know what my other, one of my, the twin brother, the one that's very Catholic, we hardly ever hear from him anymore, but I think he was more or less kind of an agnostic, mm-hmm. I think. And that's about it, as far as we're concerned. What else can I tell you?
When you first came, it was 1933. What was your and your family's experience of the Great Depression?
We didn't notice it. In fact, later when I got older, and you know, I'd hear all these stories about the Depression, I was rather surprised because we were never wanting. And when my dad had a reasonable retirement, and he had very good experience in the islands in terms of real estate. He made a little money in real estate. So I grew up without realizing that we were even in a depression. But when I learned about it was from Bill, my husband. He would tell me how terrible it was.
Did he grow up in L.A.?
Oh, yes. He grew up largely in Eagle Rock. And he, you know, he had to go and sell apples. And his older aunt had to, the oldest in his mother's family had to quit school to go to work. And they really had a rough time. So he was telling me, you know, all about it. And then later on when I was doing some interviewing with some of these Filipino first wave people who are now in their, maybe in their 80s, they experienced the depression here. And of course that was one of the reasons why they were so discriminated against, was because of the depression, you know. And they would take whatever jobs they could get, you know, out in the fields or houseboys as houseboys or whatever they could get. And it was, you know, because of the depression and the discrimination. Like you can read today with some of the big feelings against the so-called rising tide of immigration in this country, and we have to stop it, you know, and so forth. Again, you know, with the depression here today, you get a lot of feeling against people of color taking jobs away, you know, from the whites. And that's the same thing that I hear, you know, from before. But as far as my remembrance of the depression, we didn't feel it at all. Of course, I feel it now, you know, with what's happening today, because I hear about a lot of friends losing their jobs. And so I kind of, I'll say today I'm beginning to understand even further, you know, what it was like. It must have been like during the Depression, you know.
What ties did you maintain with the Philippines after you had come here?
Well, of course there were letters coming all the time. My mother would get letters from the family, and I'd get letters from my schoolmates that would still be there. By the way, most of them are here now. In fact, we have reunions of the school where we went every other year. I'm going to one in October this year in Daytona Beach. because of the large family of my mother's and the good times we had there, In fact, it's only just recently that I haven't been back to the islands. Usually after After I was married, after finishing school, on the average, I would go back for a vacation for at least a month every 2 years. And I wouldn't stay too much in Manila, because Manila's so much like any other Western city. But I'd just love to go back to my mother's place. And that's where you really feel the hospitality of the people and their sincere joy in being together again, enjoying the conversation and the food and the picnics and the swimming and so forth and so on, eating the native fruits. No more thinking that the oranges and apples are the greatest, you know. Go back there and enjoy the mango and the chico and the camachili and the santol and the duhat, whatever. Delicious. I hope to take you there someday, maybe.
I would love to go.
So I keep a very close relationship. In fact, Bill and I have been back together there at least 3 times. And one time we took the whole family there, all the 4 boys and Bill and myself. I think it was during one of my sabbaticals. When I was growing up there, the only part of the Philippines that I knew was from Manila, which was located by Manila Bay, which is about half the length of the big island called Luzon. And a day's trip by bus to the northern part of that island, which is Lagawag, my mother's place, via Baguio, which most of the Western world knows about because it's up in the mountains and it's cool, and that's where a lot of the government officials and foreign-borns would go for their vacations. That was about the only place in the Philippines that I knew. But then when I went back after being married with my 4 kids, we went all over the Philippines, and that I enjoyed that with my own family. And my sister that I mentioned before, who remained in the Philippines because she got married, her husband was in the shipping business. So during those trips, we were able to use the company ships to go sailing all through the islands. And not only the ships, but different places in the islands, they would have their company houses complete with housekeeping facilities, servants, and even a car and a chauffeur. So we really traveled all over those islands. And I'm so happy, you know, that I really had, and my family really had this opportunity, because today you couldn't do that same thing because of the unrest, you know, in the islands. So that even created even stronger feeling, you know, for my identification with the Philippines and being part Filipino. This is my heritage.
This is
so beautiful.
Going back, yes.
Going back, and then the culture. You know, the culture depicted in the dances and the music, which has flourished, since I left, has become so rich, you know, that when I saw that Bayanihan, comprehensive isn't the word I'd choose, but it's close enough. It shows all the dances and the songs that shows and depicts the diversity of the Filipino people in terms of their languages, so many languages, their dress is so different, so diversified, their actions, even their dance actions, you know, up in the northern where they're very, very saving, and you know, their dances would be like this, where they would hold their fists like this because they're so tight with their money, you know. They're even the shoulder.
Yeah, they hold and their then, fist.
Like this, real
up,
tight.
Straight up.
Oh, yeah, like this, you know. In the middle Philippines, it's a little bit more open, you know.
The hands are a little more open.
But then in the Visayan Islands, further south, they're very happy and carefree, and their hands are all like this, you know. I'll take you someday to see some of these dances, and you can see that. And I've learned this from whom they call Tita Betty, who was one of the students of Manila Normal School, where they trained or taught teachers. I never use the word train anymore, teachers, because one of my very good friends who passed away rather young, but she was a professor, she said, never use the word training teachers, because you train dogs, you don't train teachers. You teach, you educate. We're educators. Okay. Well, anyway, when I saw that, because when I was growing up, I used to go to my mom's place, and they'd do the dances in their place, in the dress.
Did you learn the dances?
Yeah. In fact, I dance some of them. Don't ask me to do one, because I have to practice it. Well, anyway, I saw this for the first time at the Shrine Auditorium in 1954 when a dance troupe called the Bayanihan came to perform. And I hadn't gotten to the time when I was visiting back in the islands regularly, this every 2 years, like I was saying. But so I read in the papers about this dance troupe coming from the Philippines to perform. I said, well, I wonder what that is. So I went over to see it. And I'm telling you, Amy, this was the most beautiful presentation that I've ever seen, you know. And it was coming from traveling from the Philippines to Europe. I forget whether it was Belgium or where Sol Hurok saw it perform and invited the team to come to the States to perform. And it was all this Philippine music with all the dances and costumes and everything. It was just beautiful. And I said, hey, you know what? That's part of me, you know. And that was really the beginning of my pride in being, you know, who I was. And I still remember going home and telling Bill, you know, all about this and whatnot. And since then, I've become very good friends with this. They now call her Tita Betty. It's kind of a nickname for her. And the rundalia, which is a stringed instrument that sounds very Spanish, but it's not really Spanish. It's very, I don't know quite how to describe it. From then on, you know, that I attribute that as one of the beginnings, you know, that stirring of pride and that part of my culture. Can we stop just a minute?
Uh-huh.
I have to leave at 3.
Okay. I wanted to ask you what the traditional expectations for Filipino women were, and did your family have certain expectations for you?
Well, the Filipino women, very early, even before the time of the Spaniards, they were very egalitarian in their relationships with others, with the men. They had more or less an equal division of labor. The men, sometimes the women would, you know, go hunting or whatever, and the men would stay with the kids, or else it would be changed around. They shared things, you know. And and this is what I've heard from others who have researched all of this and whatnot. And we're very proud of the fact that even after the Spanish and the Americans, when those colonization periods ended, it wasn't very long before the women again regained, you know, their position. The men would usually laugh, you know, and says, yeah, you know, the women, they control the purse strings, you know, whatever we earn, they give it to. But I'm the boss of the family, you know, that's the joke that goes around. But however, when the Spaniards came with the sword and the cross, that's what people say about, if you want to say it in a few words, about the Spanish colonization, the women were, you know, really put down into the what people usually think in terms of stereotypes of women of color, you know, that they are subservient to the male and things. And so, but there was always that feeling, you know, in terms of the family and things among the women and the men. And then, of course, it was a little better when the Americans came, because they did restore some of the privileges. I think it was during the occupation that